Welcome to Get in the Herd, a podcast about addiction and recovery brought to you by the McShin Foundation. If you or a loved one are looking for real discussions about addiction, recovery, stigma, advocacy, and most importantly, hope, then stick around. Thanks for joining us. Now sit back and get ready for another great episode of Get in the Herd.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the award-winning recovery podcast, Get in the Herd. My name is Nathan Mitchell. I am your host today. And before we start anything, I want to give a little shout out to the Phoenix who gave me this little Yeti the other day when we did our little exercise thing. This is keeping me caffeinated and jacked, so y'all can understand that. Justin over there looking at me like, caffeinated, yeah. Our special guest today is Joseph LMS Green. The LMS part I'm interested in, but Joseph Green today, he's a spoken word artist up in the Northern Virginia, D.C. area, came down here today because he is heavily featured in the soon-to-be-released or the upcoming release of the documentary feature film Tipping the Pain Scale by Greg Williams of the Anonymous People. So welcome to the show, Joseph. Man, I appreciate you.
Oh, yeah. No, I, you know, it's still fresh in my bones, you know, people being excited to have me in a space. And so, you know, when you spend, you know, a portion of your life being the person that people are like, is he staying? Does he realize that the party's over and everyone's going home and like, why is he still on my couch? It's nice. Yeah. It's nice to be invited and excited. People will be excited when you walk into a space. So yeah. Thank you for having me here and for facilitating a space like this for conversations like the ones that I know you have in here. So
yeah, we do get to have a lot of cool conversations. If you want, there are couches in almost every office in this building. Mm-hmm. So if you ever need to, we've got you covered.
Oh, linger? Yeah. I remember just looking to the nostalgia of lingering. Yes.
The nostalgia. Oh, my goodness.
That one might be a little small, though.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, it would look appropriate, you know, just legs hanging off. And,
right.
I think my jacket's underneath him.
The nostalgia of lingering.
Yes.
Now, so I know you are a spoken word artist.
I am.
And the way you craft words, like I love anything that when I was reading through your website and I was listening to your story. And of course, I've heard you speak in person and I've seen you in the movie because I got a preview of it already. You know, I am speechless. Speechless. I mean, as silly as that sounds, I'm almost speechless because I am at once intimidated and inspired. If that makes sense. And
it does.
Yeah, it's sort of like my using. Like I wanted more, but I knew I didn't want more at the same time. How did you get into that? And how did you find that this was the fuel for your recovery, if that's accurate?
Is that accurate? It is accurate. There are several ways to speak of it. We can go back to the beginning, and that's 11th grade. And I had a teacher in my high school. She was right out of college, and spoken word poetry was kind of a big thing in her scene. And it was a creative writing class. And I was a theater kid. And she was like, yo, we're going to write poems, spoken word poems. And I was like, what does that mean? Like a poem you're going to perform. And there's no time limit. I'm like, there's no time limit because up until that point, every bit of poetry had been structured inside of something, mm-hmm. you know, and I liked that, but I was not someone who followed instructions well, nor did I want to be confined by something. So I wrote this 4.5 minute thing and performed it. And, you know, sometimes the groove in the record is cut deep because of something tragic or something embarrassing. And then every once in a while, the groove in the record is cut deep because somebody tells you you're good at something and you didn't realize you were, right? And so the memory of her being excited about my performance and my classmates being sort of in awe that I kind of stepped out of that framework of what was socially acceptable in high school spaces and really gave myself to this project. It doesn't mean it was a great poem. It was just the process in and of itself, just like, wow, that person went all in on this. So that was just a lingering memory that I had. But I went to school for theater and have always been a performative person. And then after touring for 2.5 years doing children's theater, realized that that's not what I wanted to do with my life. What it took to become famous or even just sustained in that space wasn't what I was willing to do. And the world wasn't as connected as it is today. So I really didn't understand like what it would have been like if I would have moved to New York or if I would have moved to LA, but I was here in Richmond actually. And so I decided I wanted to give spoken word poetry a try. There was a scene here in Richmond out of the Firehouse Theater, and we were a beautiful gang of folk, and it was like chosen family. And that memory of chosen family sort of stuck with me even through my hardest times in active addiction, because there was a moment where I had abandoned my chosen family, and I always had writing with me. And I realized that once I was able to start sharing my writing again, that I could open myself and my heart to that family. And so very similar to group, very similar to being in the rooms, you know, there are people with stories. And once we start connecting with our stories, there's an empathy that's created between us. And in that empathy, community is built. And so I have no idea if I answered your question. And that's probably going to happen several times. You probably have like a code word I start to ramble like that. But yeah, it was there for me. And then there's like a specific story, like this is how poetry saved my life. But ultimately, it was a way for me to re-enter the world after recovery that brought people closer. After a period of my life where I had pushed everybody away. That makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense. And so my I guess interviewing style is very conversational, and I have ideas of what I'd like to hear and what I think we'd like to hear, but I'm much more interested in throwing something out and fishing and seeing what comes back.
Okay.
And you are the best. You are one of the best to fish at, because okay, I know there's going to be some big giant fish coming back. You and I have a lot of, and I don't know if you know this, you probably don't, but you and I have similar stories, some similarities in our story. You know, we're both children of military family. You know, we're both military brats. We moved around a lot. Yeah. I did as well. And I lived in Virginia Beach for a long time, my connection with Virginia, and then my father's in Florida. But we lived overseas as well. I think, did you live in Japan? Is that what it was?
No, I never lived.
It was Germany.
Yeah, I never, nope. That's not me. I never lived anywhere overseas. I have visited and been there, but the nature of my father's work and the fact that my mother was not particularly excited about picking up and moving to another country. My father was stationed in Korea. My father was stationed in Turkey. I got to go to Russia. I got to go to England. But like, these are visits there. We never actually lived on base in any other country.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there's a story you tell, and I know you know the story. You probably know the story I'm thinking of. There's a story you tell about being surrounded by a bunch of people who are different than you, and you
oh yeah, that was Russia.
That was in Russia.
That was in Russia. Yeah.
And you can tell that story if you like. I just what I'm hearing and what I would love to hear is those parallels that you have with my story. You know, I'm a theater kid too.
I can tell.
And it does come out, right? Yeah. Exactly. And so when you're talking about that chosen family, I feel that on a granular level, because that's like, you know, and then every, you know, 6 weeks or 5 weeks or whatever, you know, the show ends and boom, you've got another family you get to choose. And you go through a period, or at least I go through this period. And I haven't done anything on stage in, well, obviously this, but I mean like anything where I'm acting in years, many, many years. And that down cycle can be really, you know, for me, I was still in active addiction the last time I was, you know, on stage. And so that down cycle was really harsh.
Yeah.
You know, that disconnect again, you know, it's like, oh, I got to do this again.
Yeah. It's interesting that you say that, because that parallel is not something that I find very often. I went to 5 different elementary schools, mm-hmm. right? And so that was the beginning of me learning that if I wanted to have friends, if I wanted to be able to just have, you know, someone to talk to, I would have to be able to open myself up very quickly. Yeah. And then I go into middle school and high school and I discover theater. And the same thing that you say, right? Like you have the show, everyone's there. It's 6 days a week rehearsal. It goes for 6 weeks. You do the show, everyone's clapping, and it's like this amazing experience, and you're hugging, and you think you found like a partner, like a girlfriend, and then as soon as it's over, yeah. Right? It's like coming down alone in a hotel room. And like the party's over and nobody's there and you don't know who you are without that identity. And I became used to that because of the military lifestyle. And then I became used to it because of being in theater for so long. And I think that there's a positive and a negative to it. The positive is I can walk into any room and talk.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I can walk into any room and talk. The other problem is that because I'm afraid of that feeling of down, I leave people easy, right? Like there are people in my life that I wish I would have kept in touch with. And the ones who are still in touch with me is because they are the kind of people that stay in touch with folk. And I have very few lifelong friends. And so that's the other side of that. And I think the healthy version of it is being able to be that, have that, and then choose to sustain certain relationships and not fear the down, right? It's like, and when I was younger in my 20s, it was like, I need another project. And it's the same way, you need another line. It was just a different manifestation of addictive traits in me. And you know, I wish there was a web of causality that I could draw that went back to say, you know, it was at this moment where if you would have gone left, or if someone would have intervened and said this, you would have seen this pattern before it formed. And so that's part of the work now, though, right? Part of the work in coming on to this show or agreeing to be filmed in a movie, a documentary, or just doing a keynote where I'm sharing my story is so that maybe I can point the pattern out to someone before they get caught into it.
Okay.
One of the reasons.
Well, I love that web of causality.
Yeah.
Causality. And I think you just answered the question. Because my first thought was, how does that serve you?
Yeah.
You know, how does that serve you identifying those moments? And then when I think at the end there, you were pivoting into, then I can identify that, you know, have other people see those moments and hopefully identify that for themselves before it gets to be.
And I can do it now myself also, you know, going into the pandemic, you know, what a setup from the universe, right? You know what I mean? Like it was just like, hey, come in here for 2 years by yourself and fall into all your bad habits.
Here's $1,200 extra that you didn't
expect. Yeah, exactly. Here's some money. And luckily for me this time around, and this is one of the things I've identified, is that, you know, I need people in my life. And so I'm married and I have a 2-year-old son, and my 8-year-old son was living with us at the top of the pandemic, but now he's with his mother in New Mexico. But having those people and staying close to those people and allows me to see the pattern, embrace the pattern, because the pattern is my human nature, and then clearly see the reasons why I try to avoid the pattern. And do certain things that I don't particularly enjoy, but they allow me to stay on the straight and narrow, if you will. And so it serves me.
do the things you don't particularly enjoy.
Yeah, like work out or just the things that I do. Like there's, I don't particularly enjoy reading. I'm a writer. I don't particularly enjoy reading. So I listen to books. That's how, and it's not like I don't like words. It's just like my attention span and the way I exist don't allow for me to like be, I can be on the same page of a book for 45 minutes, just staring. And my mind is gone. And then I come back and I'm like, what did I just read? And then I'll read it again. And then like, it'll spark the same thought, but in a different direction. And that's ADHD. And we're working with that. But there's so many things that you have to do and you have to settle for the satisfaction of the product as opposed to the journey of that particular thing. And I think that's true for a lot of folks early in recovery or even folks who are trying to sustain long-term recoveries. There's certain things that we do that we, you know, that are hard or not necessarily in line with the human nature that we've grown accustomed to identifying with ourselves, but we understand that if we do those things, then we get the continued relationship with family and we get to pursue certain career things and we get to look ourselves in the mirror and not feel shame and so on and so on and so forth. So it's different for everybody. Some people love working out and some people love meditating on a regular basis and things of that sort. And I have a problem doing anything repeatedly that's good for me. that's good for me, but I find the strength to do so because of what I get for it.
Well, then I have a question because I have the ADD, probably the ADHD, but I've been diagnosed the ADD and I joke about it. That's why I say the ADD. And you talk about the book and being stuck on there for 45 minutes. I feel that too. And at the same time, there are moments, and I can't think right now what, but there's moments where you actually go through a book and it just captures my attention. And I actually, you know, it's I would say it's almost akin to the obsession of getting the next use, but in a good way. Because I think of those moments and where the story is so riveting and so just, I want to know. I want to live this life. I want to be in this. And I find, yeah, it's kind of funny because I do tend to listen to books on tape or not tape, but you know what I mean? Books as well.
You're old.
I am old.
I went to the library to pick up some books on tape.
But I love libraries.
Yeah.
And I love the smell of books and the tactile experience of having the book in the hand. And when it's a new book, I'm like, I'm the first one to open this book. It's almost spiritual. It is spiritual. It's not almost. It's spiritual because you're sharing a space with someone who has given themselves to you. And at the same time, you know, if that person's not capturing, well, you know,
yeah,
I'm out of it. But there's moments when they're capturing. Like, so what moments for you? Like, obviously, you've read books.
Yes.
Who captures your attention? Who do you say, wow, I want to know more about that person or that story or I want to know that?
Well, it's that is a very interesting question that I've never. I feel like I'm. I don't know who it was, but Sarah Palin and someone that said, "So, what newspapers do you read or something?" And I'm like, "Oh no, I can't remember any of them. People are gonna think I don't read stuff."
I'm sorry, did not mean to make
No. That's like that's just the anxiety jumping in. I tend to read books about people's lives. And my search is for how people accomplish incredible things in spite of our disastrous humanity, right? Like everybody that you can think of, there's more than the story that we learned in school. So I love reading autobiographies about great people because in a good autobiography, you get to learn how they learned from their failure, how they got up in spite of, and I think it brings people down to a level where I can imagine how to live that way, right? Like, and when you go to school, you know, you see the Martin Luther Kings and the Kennedys and the and everything about the way they teach those people. It's like you have to, you know, be, it's almost like they're superheroes, right? They've risen to a space of mythology, and it's really difficult to, you know, do good things on a regular basis, knowing that you'll never ascend to that level of mythology. And sometimes when you're alone and that character moment is happening where you have to do the right thing in spite of anyone being there to see you do it, being able to call back to stories of, you know, Martin Luther King being a real person and doubting himself, of knowing that, you know, Kennedy had this whole other lifestyle that was going on, but still was attempting or at least being this figure for Americans during this very tumultuous time to know and humanitize folks. And I think I might have coined that word. You've been humanitized. but yeah, to bring humanity to these folks helps me bring mythology to my humanity, if that makes sense, right? Like, yeah. I can look at accomplishing being in recovery as a mythological task compared to the person that needed to be in recovery. And I can find pride in that and understand that my recovery may not be the speech on the March on Washington and the speech at the Capitol, on Lincoln, at the steps of the Lincoln Monument, but it was a monumental thing. And I should be proud of that. And that's a story worth being told and a story that would inspire other people. Because otherwise, I could just look at my life and just be like, you know, yeah, I'm a good performer or like whatever. But like compared to, and I have a lot of people in my sphere that if you're just looking at us on paper, have accomplished, you know, National Book Award. I have friends who won National Book Awards and people who are in Hollywood and people who are producing movies and just friends around me that have done amazing things. And if I didn't have a way to make my life feel like it mattered, I could very easily die in comparison. And I think that's what I'm trying to do. I've never had this conversation before. So these thoughts aren't coming out like very precise.
I like that.
Yeah, yeah. But that's where I am. That's where I am and why I think that means something to me.
I think Nathan struggle with that sense of purpose. Mm-hmm. Do I do something that matters? And you know, I can go down the rabbit hole of comparing myself to my friends or even my siblings, mm-hmm. you know, oh, you've bought houses and have kids and you're married and you've got careers. And I mean, obviously I have a career, but you know, it's like, I can go down that rabbit hole. And I think the real superhero, you know, at least Nathan as a superhero is the actually getting up and doing the daily thing.
Exactly. Like,
you know, this morning I sat in bed and I was confused by the alarm clock because I thought it was Sunday morning. And I thought, frick, it's 5 o'clock in the morning already. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like going and swimming because I've been, ever since I got back from Vegas, I felt really out of shape in Vegas. And I said, I don't want to look like this. Yes, the look and the vanity, but like, I don't want to feel like this. I don't want to feel like this next year. And it's like, I'm sick of puffing up the two flights of stairs there, you know? And so I'm like, all right, I love to swim. I belong to a gym that has a freaking pool. I'm going to start using that. I belong to the gym for almost a year. I went 3 times before I went to Vegas.
Yeah.
You know, and then after I got to Vegas, I made a decision. I'm like, you know, I can change something. This is what I can change. Yeah. And I've been doing it. And this morning I got up and like, I don't want to do it. And I have an Alexa, you know, so I hollered, computer, snooze, you know, and so he gave me another 10 minutes of sleep and I'm not going to get up. And then I said, all right, computer, stop. And I got up and I had to tell him to stop again because he starts reading up the news. Anyway, long story short, it's like I actually got up despite myself, got to the pool. Now, this doesn't make me a superhero, but it's like I'm okay. You know what? As I'm doing the laps, I'm like, oh, I don't want to do this. It's cold.
Yeah.
The heater in there is broken. So it's really cold in the pool.
Well, I think the question has to be asked, is it how many people witness me do an act equal its heroicness or simply the doing of the act? And so if one person is listening to this show right now and they're struggling with wanting to get back into their health. And you did what you did this morning and came on this show and spoke about it. And that person gets back into their health and they, web of causality, they become a better version of themselves for the people in their lives. And you never hear about it. Does it make a noise? You see what I mean? But you know what I mean? Yeah. So yeah. That's the character part of it all, right?
But that's why I tell my story.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, you are paid to tell your story. You are a storyteller.
I am.
You also encourage and empower others to tell theirs.
Yes.
And I love what you do. Like the first time I had a, you know, one-on-one talk with you, we talked on the phone, a couple months ago, and I'm like, oh, your dedication to working with children is so that's so beautiful to me. And I think that's wonderful. Do you want to show the video? Can we show a clip of what you do?
Yeah, yeah. I'll pull it up right now.
This might be a good time to pause and do that. So I can hear Honesty in the staff meeting happening over there.
Honesty.
That's our CEO. Her name is Honesty.
Oh.
you'll meet her tonight.
Okay. All right. We're getting muted here. Okay.
Okay.
Smear makeup onto disgust if you must. Trust the truth is seldom pretty, but she is always beautiful.
I believe in the power of story to connect people through the celebration of our differences and its ability to reflect reality so that we might become the best version of ourselves.
I am a spoken word artist, and if you don't know what a spoken word artist is, I talk poetry aloud. I am a father, I am an educator, and I am proud to say that I am in long-term recovery, and that is something that is very important to me. Yes.
I believe that shame, stigma, silence, and hate are our worst enemies. But more than that, I believe if our actions are guided by kindness and love, there's nothing we can't overcome. In redemption and recovery. We all have something we are recovering from. And no matter how severe the fall, we all possess the ability to rise again.
Let us use this light and this life and these words as a beacon of hope for anybody who has ever considered themselves a lost cause. We fight for the broken and the breakers,
the damaged and the damagers, the feared and the fearful, so they know that we are not alone, that we are all here hurting and healing together. Yeah. We fight.
I believe our only goal shouldn't be to merely stop youth from doing something, but rather to guide them towards a life lived with joy, activism, and an unshakable sense of purpose. I believe that nobody is voiceless, but rather we live in a world where certain groups of people are ignored or taught their voices don't matter. Once we make room for those voices and those stories, whatever spaces we occupy immediately become more caring and compassionate.
Your story is important. Your story matters.
My name is Joseph Green. This is LMS Voice.
It's Oof. It is beautiful to look back at that. I'll talk into the mic. It's beautiful to I play that, and it gets played so often that I don't take time really anymore to look at the pictures because the images, and I'm blessed to be alive in a time where a lot of the work I've done has been captured somehow in some way. And yeah, those are good, lots of good moments there.
When I saw this unshakable sense of purpose.
Yeah, you even oohed when we just watched it now.
Because, I'd forgotten. I knew I'd pulled that out of somewhere because it's when you see my office, you'll see I have a board with a whole bunch of things written on it, little inspirational thing. And I wrote that. After I heard that, and I'd forgotten, I got it right from there. So, and of course, you're quoted there. And you know, what gives us that unshakable sense of purpose? You know, if you're like, for instance, you know, like I told you, our greatest, our largest audience are individuals who are currently experiencing incarceration,
yeah,
and throughout the Commonwealth. And so much of what we do has been born of this pandemic because we haven't been able to put our jail programs in. I don't know if you know this. I came through a McShin jail program.
I did not know.
I started my recovery journey through there. And yeah, it was that authentic, you know, someone who came in whose politics completely different than mine, thought yeah, a lot of different things, but he had that unshakable sense of purpose that he came in and he gave me that hope because, you know, politics or anything aside, like he came in and said, you know what, I was in your shoes. He had literally been in that jail and he'd literally been able, he was able to not only connect as a person in recovery, but someone who had been in the exact same spot.
Yeah.
And that was so powerful to me in a moment where, you know, I had gotten in there and really I just wanted to move into a different room that that didn't involve the guy that was harassing me in the other block.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, getting in there and trying to make it, you know, deciding to make that change, because that's really what at least my recovery teaches me, is that I get to decide to make a change and then I get to go with it and build this community. And so when we didn't have that access anymore, we couldn't put people in, you know, suddenly this became an option, an opportunity. And so now whether we have the programs in or not, it's like, okay, let's keep doing this because I love doing this. Mm-hmm. And we get to have people like you come in and share, you know, recovery journey. And then we get to have people who just got out of jail who come in here and talk about what happened. And then, you know, and so I get people who come in here and ask me about certain things in my life, which is really weird because, mm-hmm, you know, how would they know except they heard it through here?
Yeah. That happens a lot.
Yeah, I bet it does to you. So what do you say to somebody who hasn't discovered yet that unshakable sense of purpose?
Yeah, so I was sitting here. I knew that this would be the question at the end of all of this and trying to form an answer that
I was giving you time.
Yeah, and I appreciate it, you know, because it's not something that I walk around and I'm like, here's my unsensible shake of purpose answer. For me, it's not about a thing. And you just really kind of articulated it very well. Your passion isn't working in prisons. Your passion isn't doing podcasts. Your passion is in creating connection. Your passion is in helping people on their journey to becoming the best version of this, of themselves. Your passion is believing in redemption and having the conviction, mm-hmm, of your beliefs to make it happen and going into places where people have abandoned humanity, right? Especially, I do a lot of work in jails and prisons also. And like the first time I ever went into one for young people, the thing that shook me to the core was like, how nothing here says we believe you can get better.
Yeah.
Like not one structure, not one flower, not one poster on the wall, not one color that invokes hope or just no, nothing here says this is not the last stop for you. You know, and so what we realize is that we have to then be that thing when we go into those spaces, right? Because the space itself is not conducive to it, and we have not convinced society to invest in it in a way that is meaningful. So we have to go in and do that work and be that light ourselves. But if that doesn't work, if your passion, if your unsensible, your unshakable sense of purpose is redemption, or if your unshakable sense of purpose is kindness, or it's whatever, it's you take that emotion or that feeling to the next thing that will allow you to do it, right? So I thought I wanted to be an actor, but I didn't know why, right? I wanted to be an actor, but I didn't know why. And then I got into poetry and I thought I wanted to be a poet, but I didn't know why. I was good at it. I was good at both of those things. The people clapped for me when I did them. And that felt good. Being good at something or enjoying a thing feels good for a bit. But if you don't know why you're doing it beyond that, it feels good for a bit, right? Like, this thing that you do gets hard. Coming up with topics, being able to have conversations, doing it on days where you don't feel like doing it, having guests that don't talk back to you. This thing is not easy. So your joy for it will get you but so far, but your unshakable sense of purpose is what brings you back every day, right? And so, and that is something that's larger than the thing itself. I think when people get caught up in, you know, I have a line in a poem that says, there's a difference between being a rock star, there's a difference between living like a rock star and actually being one, right? And those who are quote unquote rock stars have dedicated their life to the art form, right? They are masters of their craft. They're the people who are in their room after the party's over, still playing, still trying to find a thing. And in that discovery, they create something that the whole world can nod their head to, right? And then there's a lifestyle that we've built around that, right? That is what some people look at and say, that's what I want. But if that's all you want, you don't have an unshakable sense of purpose, right? You have a desire to feel good and have fun. And so even if you pick up a guitar and are talented at it, you're not going to last long. You're going to get absorbed into that space and it's going to overwhelm you. And it breaks a lot of people. So that when I think about it, it doesn't matter if you're shining shoes, cleaning toilets, if you're like me for 7 years and you're bartending or working, I worked in retail for so long. And I worked in warehouses and I worked the front desk and I've cleaned in the kitchen. I've done all of those jobs. And the thing that got me through them was when I realized that I'm actually here to be in communion with these people. So whether I'm selling shoes or I'm in front of a group of young people, I'm still trying to find a way to connect people. So when I was working retail, like it became one of my missions. Like I have all of these young people here who are doing these jobs. Like how do I connect them to the thing that they want to do next? Right. How do we use this as a stepping off point? So we here, you know, society may be looking at people who do retail down their nose, but how do we, you know, make this moment be present and make this experience worthwhile? My father was in HR, and one of the things I got from my father was a love of helping people get to where they want to be. Mm-hmm. And I didn't understand that fully until I got into education and working with young people. But that same thing that allowed me to be passionate about working in retail, it's the same thing that allows me to be passionate about working with young people or getting on stages or doing any of the things that I do now. And if I were better at being a janitor than I was at being a poet, I would be a janitor and I would be proud of the work that I did. And I would work in spaces and clean for organizations that did the type of work in this world that I wanted to see done. Mm. Right. And that's when you meet people, especially in those spaces, right, as we are in this Western capitalistic, more society, like success means all of the things I can do, all of the letters behind my name, all the cars I have, come see my big ass house, excuse my language. You know, it's really, I think, a marvel to folks to walk up to the person at Starbucks and know that they're happy with their job. Because what their unshakable sense of passion is service and seeing people smile and getting people excited about their day. Now, not everybody there is going to end up there, right? But that person knows what their unshakable sense of purpose is. And when they go to their next job is going to have the benefit of them knowing who they are. And no matter what it is, they're going to be able to be outstanding at it and happy and fulfilled.
Happy and fulfilled.
Yeah.
Do you mind sharing a little bit about what got you to recovery? What brought you to the moment where you made a decision to get into recovery? Is that something that you've discussed or wished to?
Yeah, no. It's interesting because it still is, I guess, technically, but it wasn't a singular moment. So I have a very open-ended definition of the word recovery. Mm. I think too many people use recovery as synonymous with sober. Mm-hmm. And so I like to just, I have to clear that up before I start talking about my story of recovery, because if my story of recovery is a sobriety date, than all of that time that I spent trying to get my life together and seeking meditation and counsel and up until that moment where that decision was made, that doesn't count as recovery. And I think it does, right? And absolutely. So for me, I stopped doing drugs before I stopped drinking. And so and there was a good 6-year period of time difference there. And I was actually in, let's go backwards. I was living in upstate New York and things were getting out of control. And I had been kicked out of the room with the futon mattress that I was renting. Well, you can call it renting. I hadn't paid them in a very long time.
I know this space.
Yeah, you know this space. Yeah,
and I've also not paid that rent.
Yeah, I got kicked out of there, and I was staying with probably the last person in the town that would allow me to stay with them. And it just boiled down to is like you got to go, you got to go, or you're going to die, because the only thing from here is harder stuff. And you know, because if what you're doing right now can't get you to ignore the state of your life, the next level is where you don't come back from. And I had already seen that and witnessed it. And so I was lucky enough that my father had been in recovery for almost a decade, a little more than a decade, actually, at that time. And so I moved back to D.C. and I stopped doing drugs. And I lived with my parents and I worked at a gym, and I think it was 28, 29 years old, somewhere in there. And a former teacher, my coach of, I did speech and debate in high school my senior year.
Of course.
And my coach came to me and said, "Hey, I'm taking over the drama program. Do you want to coach the team?" And I'm like, "Yeah, we'll see how that works out." It was like $800 every 3 months. I was like, "Yeah, I'll try it. I'm making milkshakes at Gold's Gym right now, so I'll do whatever." And that was the beginning of me understanding my unshakable sense of purpose. When I first started working with those young people, and I realized that the best hit I had ever had was watching a young person realize they could do something that they thought they couldn't do. Mm. Right? Like, and we're talking, you know, 3 or 4 young people after school doing a forensics rehearsal, and a kid who had never, you know, spoken in front of people without stuttering or falling over themselves, you know, speaking with a sense of conviction and having people applaud and say that you did well. And then they took my faith and stepped out on faith, and they were rewarded for it. And to see that moment is when I knew what I wanted to do. I didn't know how I wanted to do it, but I knew that this, I can't leave this feeling of being there when people or facilitating when people have these aha moments, these breakthrough moments that allow them to be more sure of themselves. Because so much of the crap that we do and the discord in this world come from people just not being sure of themselves, and therefore falling into the pitfalls of things and certain behaviors and certain ways of treating folks that they know are not necessarily correct, but they don't know why they don't have a good enough reason to do otherwise. And so, like, to see these young people go from nonchalant and like, you know, whatever, to like, "Yo, I'm passionate about something." Mm. I love that. And so if I talk about my recovery, I have to talk about that being a part of my recovery, that acknowledge, finding that moment. But it would be my son, my first son. It's not a secret, but tumultuous relationship between my father and I when I was younger. It's well recorded in a poem that I do. But when my son was born, I thought I had control. And I said to myself, you know, I have him half time. And so I said, as long as I don't drink when he's here, I'm good. Hmm. And then that became, well, as long as I don't drink when he's awake, it's good. And it's like, as long as I don't drink where he can see me, it's good. And then, yeah. So obviously that didn't work out very well. And so I don't ever put it on people. And I think it's a bad habit sometimes. While that person may be the thing that's in your head, you know, like the thing that you see, to put on a person like, you know, I got sober because of my son, discounts all of the people who are having difficulty overcoming the disease, who also have people in their life that they love as much as you love your son, right? There's grace involved. There's a certain amount of privilege involved, a certain amount of circumstances that have come together for you to be able to, you know, to do this thing. And it's not just that thing that you see clearly, but he was there and that was part of it. And I knew that I couldn't be the man that I wanted to be if I didn't conquer this next thing. Mm-hmm. And that was, funny enough, what's today's date?
Today is the 22nd.
Yeah. So it was the day before Thanksgiving, 2016.
Wow.
And a friend of mine, a mutual friend, I subsequently was the last person that she drank with. I called her and I was like, yo, she's like, just go to a room. Just go to a room. So that it was the Thanksgiving Eve, I guess. I went to a room and it was in DuPont Circle in Washington, D.C. Shout out DuPont. and while I don't go to rooms anymore, the fact that it was there, you know, that's how I got into the space and got into recovery. Now, keep in mind now, I had written a poem about a friend of mine who died, Talk Ugly, which people know. They know me, they know. And I had been doing that poem in recovery spaces this entire time. And I don't think it was inauthentic, but I had never really allowed the recovery space to move me to want to be a real part of it. I thought I was outside. I thought I was a poet who had a poem who was performing, and I just came to visit, and I'm gonna go back to my life because I'm okay over here. And then, you know, that type of hubris gets knocked down hard, real, real hard. So, yeah, I mean, that's a roundabout version of the story, but yeah.
I like, well, that you've humanitized yourself.
Thank you. Let's pass it on. Hashtag humanitize.
Hashtag humanitize. 23 million people in recovery in the United States, 23 million definitions of what that means.
Yeah.
I'm grateful that you brought that distinction here to demonstrate what that is, because I think there's a, well, there's a bias.
It's dangerous.
Yeah.
It's dangerous to, it's necessary and it's dangerous. It's necessary because there needs to be definitions to things and spaces where certain things happen and confines, because folks run up and down the spectrum of, you know, affected by the disease, ability to walk away from, ability to manage. But the what's dangerous about it to me is the 10 years or so that I spent thinking that I was fine because I didn't look like this particular thing. Mm-hmm. And not wanting to even think about change, because all change meant to me in popular society is abstinence, mm-hmm. right? Like, and so if the only option is to take away the thing that I've been leaning on this whole time, then I don't even want to have the conversation,
yeah.
right? Like another line in a poem, but more importantly, a philosophy that I believe is, drugs and alcohol were never the problem. They were the wrong solution.
Right? Yeah.
And until I saw a therapist and understood my depression, until I saw a therapist and understood my anxiety and my ADHD and all of these things that cause my brain to form and act differently, before I knew that there were other ways to deal with it, you weren't going to get me in a room where the only way I was allowed in that room was if I wasn't doing the one thing that was keeping me going. And so the conversation about it has to change, because there are 23 million Americans in recovery. There are 150 million Americans that need to reexamine their relationship with substances, mm-hmm. right? And just because you don't fit the I need to be sober all the time to like to stay alive portion of the world doesn't mean that you don't need to be in some form of recovery. And so I don't have an answer for that. But it is something that I'm very passionate about, as someone who has existed in between many different spaces and had conversations with folks from all over the spectrum, as it were. I look at our youth and, you know, and someone who worked in prevention for as long as I've worked in prevention. And there's just something so hypocritical about the message that we're losing people when we could be bringing them on and having a more nuanced conversation about it. So anyway, we don't have time to get into that. I can see.
Well, no, I'm looking at the time and I realized we haven't even really talked about the movie at all.
Sorry, Greg. Well,
and boy, we could go on for a couple of hours and I love that. So do you mind? Let's talk about the movie.
Yeah. So Tipping the Pain Scale.
It's good stuff.
Yeah. I got to see it in Vegas and that was the first time I saw it also. And they asked me to wait. I could have seen it before, but it'll be better to see it with all the people who are in the movie. And I can say this, about the film. It is inspirational in a way that few films are about the topic. And it brings forth conversations that need to be happening, even in spaces who think they have figured out everything they need to figure out as it pertains to how to deal with this epidemic that we have. It is beautifully diverse, and the people of which it follows and portrays, plus the people that we are working with. And so it doesn't lean to like one side or the other. It does a pretty decent job of showing the spectrum. And I know that Jeff, the director, and Greg, the producer, were very adamant about making a film that reflected America's problem, not just the opioid, not just this, not just that. Like if you look at the people that are in it, and it ranges, and I think that's super important also, because representation in these spaces saves lives. It saved my life. We can talk about that on a different day. But I was telling Jeff, I said, you know, you take any six people who do this type of work and you can make a film this compelling, right? Just because it's not me, it's not Roz, it's not Darren, you know, we ourselves, you know, we have our stories, but it was an honor to have what I've gone through and the work that I now do because of that be highlighted in a way that I think is going to, one, help people reflect and see that in them and go forward to do really good work. You know, like this is a movie that's going to do work. Like it has legs. It's going to be out in our community for a while. You know, there's the viewing tonight and people are going to walk away from this. And not only like the people like us who do this work, but the people who are in homes right now who are coming to see this movie. People are in day one, day two of their recovery, and they're going to see all of the different ways that recovery lives. Mm-hmm. And I think that's vital. I used to run a mentoring program out of DC, and our like internal motto was, if you can't see it, you can't dream it, right? And so our goal was to show young people all of the different careers and things that they could do, especially young people coming from neighborhoods that most of them had never been out of. And in the same way, if you have been going along your life, living wherever you live, and you find yourself in a space where you are in recovery now, you know, there's a chance, a really good chance, that you haven't seen a lot of examples of people in recovery, right? And so you may think that there's no space for people like you. You may think that there's no life after this space. You may think that there's no joy or good work after this space. But when you see this film and the other films that these gentlemen have worked on together, you see that there is so much more life. There's so much more to do, and there's so much work to be done. And, Yeah, and it's done by normal people.
Yeah.
It's just like just everyday freaking people. And sitting on the stage after the show in Vegas, I told my wife later, I was like, yo, I felt small. Like I felt small because I was around giants. Like yeah. Roz was on my left.
Yeah.
And like when I first saw the preview to the movie, she had reversed something like 165 overdoses. By the time the movie came out, she was in the 600s, right?
Wow.
Yeah, no, she's rocking it.
Wow.
And in a space and with a demographic of people that has been written off, right? Yeah. You know, the idea that you go out to the streets and you reverse these overdoses for these, and you hug these people and you love these people, it's it's divine almost, right?
Yeah.
And then my man in Boston, who is De La Rosa, who's doing the...
And he'll be here tonight, by the way.
Oh, he will?
Yeah.
Oh, awesome.
He's with Sean right now, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I didn't know that. Yeah, yeah. Josh, so like, the, you know, defying our understanding, because I mean, a lot of folks in our world have interesting relationships with the law. very interesting relationships with the law. And aside from America's reckoning with policing that's going on right now and race and all of that other stuff, just the idea that there are people who got into a profession for the right reason and are manifesting that in their actions against the popular grain of how, you know, it's easier just to deal with these folks by putting them in jail and, you know, and just
yeah.
throw away the key, that he has that compassion and that in him. And hopefully other people will see him do it and say, oh, I can do that same thing. I can have that program here, or I can extend myself in an extra way. And yeah, just, you know, from Marty to Lauren, everybody in the movie, just to be on the stage with them and be like, wow, these people save lives, and I am honored to be herald to the work that they do. And this is not to discount my own journey in it, but I was just like, yo, I would have been just as happy sitting in the audience and just being like, look at them. So yeah,
Greg was on the show on Friday, as mm-hmm. you know, and Greg actually mentioned that moment as well, and how powerful it was to watch you all interact after having seen that moment. And you'll appreciate this. Roz was actually in my cohort, my pod yeah. We did a recovery
narrative training.
Yeah. and here's Roz, and she opens up with this, her really, and I'm like, I didn't know where to go with that. And there were two of us. We had it's a long story, yeah. but we both kind of went, wow, that's really, we don't know where to go. And then we tried to coach her. How crazy.
Yeah.
And afterwards I'm thinking, what the hell? How do we get that? Because you know, clearly
you have to see the movie
yeah.
to fully understand Oof. The phenomenon that is Roz. And I don't want to big her up too much. She's a human being. And the reason why I don't want to big her up, for the same reason we were talking about earlier, I don't want to put her into some sphere of mythology where like you yourself couldn't go out and be a Roz for your community. But you got to give props where props are due.
Yeah.
And to overcome what she's overcome and to still have a heart of giving in a world that has taken so much from her is something that we should be clapping about. You know, we throw people up on mantles for, you know, being billionaires and millionaires, for accumulating so much stuff, that we rarely applaud people for the type of wealth that really matters. And Roz is just full of the type of wealth that really matters. And so,
well, I want to be mindful of your time.
No, that's good.
I know you got a long night ahead of you still.
Yeah.
And we're at the 58 minute mark. Do you have anything you want to close us? I could sit here for another couple hours, but I've asked you to do a group after this, and I want to make sure that you get to take a breather and a mind break.
Yeah.
Anything you want to share before we close out?
I got to start having these things ready.
I like the raw, man.
Yeah, the thing, I mean, the thing that's on my heart right now is I need to see more people living the conviction of their beliefs And we're at a time in our world where we have a lot of well-meaning folks who will say that they believe in kindness or believe in inclusivity or believe in recovery or believe in saving lives. You have a lot of people who will say, I see youth as the future and, you know, I donate money here and I'm a part of this thing and so on and so forth. But like the proverbial SHIT is about to hit the fan. Mm. If it's not already, like, I don't know where we are in the story of our, you know, when you look at this, you know, you look back at a time, a period of time, and like, I don't know where we are in our story. Like, maybe we're still before the line where we can change and make something happen, but there's an intersection of all of the things that are ailing our society. And as long as we only focus on the thing that's in front of our nose, as opposed to opening up and inviting other people who have different perspectives and different ideas into a space, we're not going to be able to solve these problems that are going to affect us all. And so if you believe in those things, like, we need to do more than just post about it. We need to do more than just vote about it. Like, we need to get out with our hands and actually do a thing, volunteer somewhere else, one more space. Invite over that family member that you haven't talked to in a long time. Go to the shelter and bring your children. There's so much that we can do that if everybody just did one more thing, we could make the world the place that we wanted to be. So yeah, that's where I'm at. And I know that, you know, and I could do more. We could all do more, but I just want us to do what we know we can do.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's what my heart is right now. I don't know if that makes sense to anybody who's listening, but that's my final thought.
Man, I appreciate you. Yeah. Joseph, our guest today, Joseph Green, I really have enjoyed this conversation much more than you know. Thank you, Justice.
Thank you.
I call him Justice. He's Justin. Thank you, Justin. Thank you, everybody out there watching, listening. Tomorrow and Wednesday, we're going to talk about Thanksgiving and talk about gratitude. I know it's a broad subject, but it has a lot more meaning now that I actually have relationships with my family that aren't about taking.
Yeah.
It's even not about giving necessarily, just about being present. And I like that. So we're going to talk about that for the next couple of days. And we'll be off on Thursday for Thanksgiving because I will be hopefully eating Empire biscuits with my grandmother in Goochland. So with that, thank you all very much. Thank you again to our guests here today. And we will see you, if you have not already, we'll see you tonight at 5:30 for a sneak preview. And we'll get more of Joseph.
Come see a movie.
Come see a free movie.
Free movie.
At the historic Henrico Theater. Thank you all. Have a good night.
Liller. I am the CEO of the McShen Foundation and a woman in long-term recovery. Since May 27, 2007, I have not used drugs or alcohol. Woo-hoo! Thank you so much to the Richmond Times-Dispatch and all of our voters for Getting the Herd podcast. Those podcasts are amazing. Not only has it helped thousands upon thousands of people in their recovery, as well as family members, but it has helped me in my personal recovery. I get to listen to them now in my car through Spotify and iHeartRadio. And it's just really, really important for us to be innovative in the addiction field and the recovery community. So when COVID hit, we had to be innovative. You know, we really had to think of, like, what can we do to reach people that cannot go to 12-step meetings, smart recovery, faith-based, whatever, that we're shutting down constantly. So we were innovative here at McShen. Let's start podcast. So with Todd, John, Alex, and some other staff, you know, we all just kind of jumped in who can do what. And with Todd's lead and John's lead, the podcasts have been amazing and we're still doing them today. So I want to thank you for all of your votes and all of your energy and all of your support of our mission of healing families and saving lives. Thanks.